which is sailed in gray down the University City of Fall City.
Judge Bryant had ordered that certain cash documents be produced and responsive public records request, and this court reversed it and found that they were public records. But that is actually very important for the proceeding in this case. I have reread the defendant's brief. They lay all these time lapses on Salem Gray not being dilatory, not doing things, but there was a certain subset of documents that Judge Bryan ordered in April 5th, 2013 in his possession that we couldn't get to until May 19th of 2015. So that's basically a two-year window that we couldn't get those documents. Once that stay order was issued on May 19th, 2007, the discovery process began again, and what Salem Gray discovered was that there were additional documents involving open meetings violations that weren't, some of them weren't produced until months before trial. But in that time period, the district court did two things. January 20th, 2016, it denied Salem Crane's motion for leave to file a second amendment complaint. The second amendment complaint that was proposed to be filed was based on additional open meetings act violations that had been discovered in that fairly narrow window between May of 2015 and when we moved for leave to amend again in December 2015. And by that time, the project was complete, the TIF funding was in place, and Salem Green moved also to amend the current for leave to ask for rescission restitution of the $4 million in TIF funding. And the district court denied that motion, found that there was undue delay. Again, the position of Salem Green is clearly that the undue delay was due to that was sort of the key in this case. We couldn't get the edge documents. We couldn't post the CRA witnesses. We couldn't post the full state witnesses.
How was it tied to the repayment of the TIF funds, though?
Well, the second amendment complaint is tied to the repayment.
How about the edge documents? How do you tie that back to a request that the TIF funds be reimbursed?
There were a lot of things that were happening down there. We've got the meeting that we alleged was an open meetings violation. It did go to trial. A form of CRA members were there. There was a briefing done by CGP. All of that culminated in votes that the CRA took all the way until October 2012, including the TIF funding. But all of these things were going on, and the record is clear that this was orchestrated by Edge. The email setting up the August 2012 meeting was an email from the executive director of Edge, Becky Kroger, who pointed out in that email very specifically to the CGP representatives attending that these three member people were members of the CRA, the quorum of the CRA that was there. And right after it said, CRA had said, control stiff. So until we had made sure we had everything that Edge eventually produced, again, some not until right before trial, we couldn't piece together all that had happened. What we pieced together right at the very end, and weren't allowed to present at trial, was that the quorum of the CRA and meeting as an executive committee that all through the summer of fall 2012 where every single executive committee.
So what you thought was the proposed amendments was geared to the passage of time and the actual physical development of this operation?
Well, like I said, we never challenged the construction of the operation. The challenge in 10 enumerated subparts under a declaratory judgment and prayerful relief was declare TIF null and void for this reason. And I don't see any meaningful distinction between declaring something null and void in a prayer for relief and asking for rescission. So the judge seemed to think that we were changing our entire theory, but everybody knew, all defendants knew, the court knew from the very beginning, the filing of the original complaint, that what we were asking for was a TIF being declared null and void.
They were the funds for which you sought rescission dispersed.
They were dispersed in December 2012, but we didn't, I don't know that we had that document. I'm sure we didn't have the documentation until after the denial of filing. Well, after the filing of the amendment complaint, but before the filing of the second complaint. That was part of what, where we said we know that everything's done now, we've got the checks, we've got the new bills and bonds, we need to make sure that our peripheral relief matches the status of the case.
But did the edge documents have anything to do with seeking rescission? I'm not sure. Heard the answer to Justice Stacey's question about what in the Ed documents pertain to your ability to file an amended complaint seeking rescission of funds.
Giuliani, and she was, you know, in our opinion, kind of the puppeteer behind the scenes in December 2015 when we filed leave for the Second Amendment.
If it were your lawyers and without the Edge documents, you wouldn't be able to prove up.
Well, certainly no Open Meetings Act violations. We needed to make sure that we had all those documents. I see my time's up. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Anthony. Good morning, Chief Justice, Justice of the Supreme Court.
Are you going to opposing counsel? Are you going to be splitting your time at all?
Assuming that with your questions you will grant me the opportunity to do that, my intention is to talk about what Mr. Mossman described as his first 2 points and then turn over to co-counsel to specifically address the open meetings question because quite early consolidated grain is not a governmental entity. We had nothing to do with putting out any notices, and we certainly were not in violation of the open meetings, so that would be my intention.
So you want 5 minutes?
I think 7. I think 3 minutes should be sufficient.
Okay. 7 minutes it is. Thank you.
Well, this is a case that has gone on since consolidated grain first expressed an interest in opening a facility in Fall City in early 2012. The lawsuit has been on file since the late fall of 2012, and we've been in court a number of times, and this case, or related cases, have been in front of you on a number of times already, so to try to hit all the points at this point in time would be very difficult. So let me go back, if you'll permit me, and address some of the specific things that Mr. Mossman pointed out in his argument, or attempted to point out. I was very interested to find out when he described his initial complaint and the First Amendment complaint filed on behalf of his clients, and I believe this is an exact quote, was essentially asking for rescission. That is absolutely incorrect. You can read it for yourself. They were asking for the declaratory judgment and for an injunction. And to now say that somehow they were essentially asking for rescission, or what they tried to do in their Second Amendment complaint and Third Amendment complaint is what I call the three R's: rescission, recoupment, and basically return of money. And they want to say that the court erred when it failed to allow the Second Amendment complaint to be filed. This is what happened. We were there, Consolidated Grain was there, and we made it clear from the very beginning that we were not going to build this facility in Fall City, Nebraska, unless we got TIF funds. The process went through, Salem Grain was represented, to the extent they wanted to, and all the preliminaries leading up to the granting of permission for us to build that elevator facility with TIF funds. The redevelopment contract was signed in, I believe, October of 2012. The TIF process was completed, and funds started to be moving in November of 2012, and I think what I just heard Mr. Mossman say is that somehow they wouldn't know about that, they wouldn't have known about that at the time that either their initial complaint or their First Amendment complaint was filed. If you read the record carefully, and I think if I remember correctly, on page 21 of their brief, I believe it is, they essentially acknowledged the fact that by the time they got around to the Second Amendment petition complaint, they understood that the relief, the only relief they asked for, was not possible. The case was moot, and I could not stand up here and give you any better argument than what Judge Bryan included in his order with regard to the issue of mootness when he decided that items 1 through 10, 11 had already been dismissed, were all gone, and that the only thing that would go to trial under the public interest exception, which they didn't want to dispute Judge Bryan, but I was always under the impression that you guys were the only ones who got to consider the public interest exception. But he found there was a public interest.
Could you already please stop referring to the court as you guys?
That the Supreme Court has always been the appellate court system is the entity that decides that particular issue. Now they come up and they say, well, but there was this delay. There was this stay. Again, read the judge's order. The judge's order in this case references a completely separate case wherein they sought a myriad of documents from Edge, which has never been a party to this case. Certain of those documents were granted to them at that his order, which was entered in the other case, the judge said, I'm not going to order these documents that are the subject of an appeal as to whether or not they have to be turned over. I'm not going to do anything with regard to that. Those documents are not going to be released. But there was no stay. Read his order in April of 2013. There's no stay in this case, and I can tell you because I was there, there was multiple instances of discovery that went forward between April of 2013 and the time the judge, he said, I am ordering the stay removed. But there was no official stay in this case. Discovery moved forward. I think what's interesting was one of the previous questions. Have they ever pointed out any specific in the Edge documents that were released after the stay was removed that had anything to do with their necessity to file or to request to file a second amended complaint because they realized that the recovery, the remedy, the relief they sought in their first amended complaint was now no longer possible. The facility was built. One thing that they pointed out in their brief was they said, we shouldn't have been required to go forward and try to get a temporary injunction against all of this going forward, whether or not it was the construction of the facility, whether or not it was the issuance of the TIF bond. We shouldn't have been required to accept that risk because if it was later found that that was improper, think of the damages that we would have to pay. Well, first of all, at least as I understand it, that's not the law. If they want the benefit of a temporary injunction leading to a permanent injunction to stop whatever it was that they wanted to stop, then it was their obligation to do that with proper pleadings in the court. Because if you follow their argument to its conclusion, what would have happened in this case? They file, they pay their 80 bucks or whatever it is to file a lawsuit. They ask for a permanent injunction and declaratory relief. And then they say, we shouldn't have to be the ones who come in, prove in a hearing on a temporary injunction that there's a significant likelihood that we will recover on the merits.
Each of the parties subject to an injunction, had one been sought? Is there any prohibition against an injunction with public entities and non-public entities?
There may have been a possibility for them to try to get an injunction against the issuance of the TIF funds, but in this case, they were well aware of the fact that that would have been the equivalent of an injunction against Consolidated because we made it clear to everyone from the beginning we're not going to build this facility without
without the TIF.
That's exactly right.
So the stay is expensive.
Well, the injunction
would be expensive, but you're saying that's the strategy.
I'm saying that's their strategy, and I'm saying it puts us in the place of then going forward. Now all of a sudden we have to go forward with the idea that if we build it and we lose, it's almost as if they could get us permanently enjoined for all these years since all of this happened without ever getting a temporary injunction because under their logic, if we went ahead and built, we would be the ones who now have to gamble of having put in all that money. So why have a temporary injunction process at all? They decide if they want to stop TIF, if they want to stop the building of the facility, they come in, it's their burden to show that they're entitled to a permanent in a temporary injunction, and then that allows everybody, if they're successful, it allows everybody to sit back. They chose not to do that. And now to allow them in December of 2015, more than 3 years after this case was started, to say that somehow this stay that we had nothing to do with was our fault and our responsibility is incorrect. And I'm going to turn it over. It's like I've got a little less than 2 minutes for some argument on the open meeting floor. With your permission.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Walters, good morning to you.
Good morning. Little time from New York.
Okay.
Good morning, Eric Walters here on behalf of the Community Redevelopment Authority. I'm here to speak to Assignments of Error 6 and 7, particularly the open meetings violations. So I'm going to get right to it here. November 9th emails was not an open meetings violation. The chairman in that case in the Gino was very clear that he knew if they wanted to discuss anything, if they wanted to take any other action, they needed no one of members even to let them know so that they could set up a special meeting. It seems peculiar that he would send that email and then try to circumvent the open meetings law. He was clearly aware this is what they had to do. Instead, it seems the logical explanation is, he knew, they want to have a meeting, let me know, I'll set up that meeting. Otherwise, Mr. Raddatz knew he had authority to sign that contract. He had the authority for two reasons. Number one, the changes that Judge Bryan said in the order, they were minor changes. One of them was to dispose of a lawsuit that CRA already knew about because they were in it. The other was to add some limitation of liability language that really just clarified the liability language that was already in there. But the other reason is because, and we made a mistake in our brief, the science was over 184, which the trial court did not receive, but there is another exhibit, the identical exhibit, is in the record, so exhibit 18, that was received by the court, page 477 to 490, that's going to be in the bill of exception volume 6. It was offered and received at page 49 and 50 of the supplemental bill of exception volume 1. If you go to section 12, that's the resolution that the CRA adopted in the October 16th meeting, where they adopted the TIF bond financing and the contract. And if you go to section 12, that section says, the chairman and the secretary are hereby authorized to execute and deliver said redevelopment contract in substantially the same form presented, but with such changes as such executing officers shall deem appropriate for on behalf of the authority. That language right there was what would allow Mr. Raddatz, the chairman, to execute the revised changes to the contract that came about after they had approved. I came out of time. I would request that the court affirm all the orders that are off the order in favor of Appalachia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of